I'm not gonna lie and say that. The world hasn't been around for 2,000 years. You believe slavery is okay?
No.
Well, we've just proven that, and the Bible said it.
Right. Morally. It says slavery is okay.
Yeah.
Morally,
yes,
we just proven that, right?
Your God called it.
We're not for slavery.
Yeah, Leviticus. The stuff you don't read because there are too many words for Sunday.
I think it's like 21
here in
front of
cameras. You can Google it.
Is there a God?
I could absolutely.
Okay, what's the difference?
You between God and what? You have no reason.
In terms of you being able to,
it's not about disproving it.
A religionist that comes up wrong. Like if you thought 2 + 2 = 5, no,
he's not going on.
I
wouldn't continue to put together a puzzle if I had to jam all the pieces in there every time I got to a hard part.
Hi, everybody. This is Brett. Welcome back to School Sucks. Today is December 24th, and this is part 3 in the Voluntary Communication series with Daryl Becker. What you heard there at the opening of the show was a little atheist versus religious guys debate that I found on YouTube, and it was 13 minutes long, but I decided to edit it in a way that allows you to get exactly as much out of it as the participants. Nothing. That's something that we're going to address in the show today. Daryl provided some very valuable insights on that subject, and I learned a lot from today's show. We actually recorded this a good 29 days ago, and we recorded the fourth part last night, so that'll be out in a few days. And I really look forward to getting that part to you. An extensive discussion about the little elf on the shelf that's still making trouble. For people like me, anyway. Yeah, so you know what? Let's actually get right into this. One more time, happy holidays. Merry Christmas, Hanukkah, and Saturnalia. Thanks again to everyone who's been helping support the show. I want to do a special spotlight thank you to Mike Martelli. A couple days ago, I just opened a package that he sent, the Nikon D5000 DSLR camera. I have been playing with it, experimenting with it, watching YouTube how-to videos, learning a lot about photography. So it's been in addition to an awesome donation, a very, what will in the future be a very useful piece of equipment. It's also been a fun learning experience for me. So thank you so much to Mike Martelli for his contribution to School Sucks. Got more people to thank at the end of the show today, and we are 1 week away from the end of our big fundraising month of December. I'm so grateful for all of the people who contributed. There's still plenty of time. Go to schoolsucksproject.com/AV, or right on the front page, you can see a red button that you can click, sign up. Come on in, you know? The more, the merrier, okay? Merrier for me, for obvious reasons, but I think also merrier for you. I was going through the YouTube uploads, all of our YouTube videos that have never been made public because they're bonus content. I'm saying, wow, there's a lot of great stuff in here. I remember this. What a great video. It has 16 views. Let's get more people in there to see some of this unreleased stuff, you know? Anyway, I hope you have the best holiday. We'll probably sneak one more show in before the end of the year. It will most likely be part 4 in this series, and I look forward to your feedback about these shows. Daryl and I talked last night. I know he's looking forward to some feedback. He's easy to reach. He runs the NVC group at schoolsucksproject.com. So, let us know your thoughts. And until next time, thank you so much and enjoy the show. Iron Man 3 spoilers ahead. Okay?
Tony! The world's in danger. It's time to assemble. We need you.
Rare Avengers. Need Tony. Need suit.
Oh, you guys are still around. I'm sorry, everyone. I just blew up all my suits. I'm kind of a changed man now.
Why would you blow up all your suits?
See, it was sort of metaphorical, showing Pepper that she's more important than any mission, and I'm more than just a suit. Plus, it's Christmas.
Daryl, welcome back.
Thanks, Brett.
How's Hawaii?
It is passing into the winter time, which means a slight bit more rain, and yeah, it still feels like what you would call early summer. So, yeah.
Yeah. Tropical paradise.
Somewhat, yeah. It's more paradise for those who are gainfully employed and less paradise for those who are struggling. But there's abundance here, that is for sure. As you can imagine, bananas and coconuts are quite cheap here, by the way.
Oh, coconuts. Oh,
coconuts. So, yeah. And you are over in Keene, are you not?
Yeah, it's 9 Fahrenheit here. So, burr, you know.
Brisk.
Yeah. But I'm having a great time. I've been here a week talking to a lot of people that I've wanted to spend more time with. So it's been a good experience getting out, getting fresh winter air, and feeling good.
I love splitting wood. I kind of miss that sometimes.
I really enjoy it. Lumberjacking.
Yeah. You feel the effectiveness when the axe actually slices all the way through, huh?
Oh, it's the best feeling.
It is.
I said that today. I came in. I said, man, when you split that thing in one swoop through, what a feeling.
Yeah.
I am very efficacious, I said.
So today, I'm thinking that these methods,
yeah,
they are about slicing all the way through to our objective. And sometimes, you know, when we slice down through, we hit that knot. That's
yes.
Right there. And that, we're going to just find some other tools that will act as a wedge to completely continue to go on through the firebox door so it can, you know, give us some nice BTUs.
We didn't plan any of that. We didn't say, let's have really good log splitting metaphors. That was very organic. We are going to talk about metaphors up front here. And in the times that I've heard you in discussion with other people and other shows, I always really enjoyed the metaphors that you used. I thought they, as metaphors are intended to do, they paint a very nice picture. And they also help us walk away from new ideas with something, you know, firm in our minds and in our memories. So metaphors are very, very useful. And I realized their effectiveness when I was a teacher and tried to employ as many as I could. So I thought we would start there today, Daryl.
That would be great. I would start with the first metaphor, the splinters in the mind.
Mm.
I separated them into the mental splinters. These are composed of some type of dependence or exclusive use of any of the informal logical fallacies as methods of decision-making process. And then the emotional splinters, which could be very much emotional wounds, things of trauma in the past that essentially indicate values and desires that are not adequately being tended to. They're often the stimulus, emotion, pre-programmed response pattern of choice of actions or choice of thoughts. So let me tell you some of the reasons why I chose splinters, as they are certainly something that are very common. Everyone has had a splinter. It's not a shameful thing to have had splinters or to presently possess a splinter. Mm. You wouldn't, you know, reach out and touch someone's splinter without asking if they need some help.
Mm-hmm.
And you just, you know, it's something that you also don't actually consider as a permanent medical condition. It's a very treatable condition, having a splinter. And I realize it's got some history with The Matrix and a bunch of other popular movies, Splinters in the Mind, etc.
Yep.
I think that there's usefulness in understanding that people have problems, and problems are like splinters, that everyone has a splinter or two here and there.
It's good that we are comparing this to the informal fallacies, because it starts as, in that case anyway, when we're encountering something that's fallacious, it starts as, ooh, something doesn't feel right. This needs to go through a process. Something needs to happen here. I need to work with this. And I think that emotional splinters, if we're cognizant of them, can ultimately lead us in the same direction, that, ooh, there's something I need to do here.
Exactly. It's an indicator of something that's very real.
And we did use these terms in our first show when we did definitions, but I did want to make sure that we covered this again, because as is the case with metaphors, it's a useful visual for people. And it's a way of sending a lot of information to somebody else in a way that they understand. They know when you're trying to convey this idea to other people, they know what is meant by splinters in the mind. And, you know, we just want to point out that both of these kinds of splinters exist. Do you think there's anything else we need to address with that one?
No, I think when we get further on, we're going to show some tactical examples of each metaphor. So how about the next one, Brett?
Sure, sure. This was my favorite. Well, the next two work together, but I'll do the first one, which is obviously the more important. Bridge of empathy. The bridge of empathy refers to the connection of caring between individuals, and this is a perceptible and subjectively felt quality of compassion, mutual compassion between two people who are trying to communicate. And we've talked, Daryl, in all kinds of conversations, debates, disagreements. We use words like rift and great divide or chasm. The idea of putting a bridge in that place where, you know, communication and information could not go before. What's important here is that the property of this bridge includes the qualities of only being crossable by the voluntary action from one person to another. So one cannot push or pull oneself or someone else across the bridge. Only a voluntary decision to care about each other can constitute the construction of a solid bridge of empathy.
That's pretty much it. It's what I was trying to emphasize is, at first I had this Care Bear image of, this is a magical bridge. It can only be crossed voluntarily. And then the evil cartoon character trying to, you know, essentially assert themselves and saying, I will force you across to care about the other person. It's like, no, it doesn't work like that, actually. No one can be forced to care about someone else. You can only be forced to wish that you were not there.
Right.
That can be very much a forced situation. You could really be like, now I really don't want to be here. But you will, you know, no one will ever be like forced to care about another individual. So I was trying to make this metaphor useful to say, okay, I want to make a bridge. I want to make lots of bridges between all of these individual islands called individuals.
Yeah, yeah.
They're all separate. Unless you're, you know, some Borg and you're all plugged in and we are the hive mind. Then, you know, okay, maybe no bridge is necessary because you're a science fiction character. But assuming you're in the world that I'm presently inhabiting, you're a separate individual with separate thoughts and feelings and separate motivations. And every individual is separate. So it's actually very much going in line with the general gist of individualism that is so prevalent in much of our audience.
But one of our great pursuits here, too, is also to communicate information effectively to other people. And that brings us to the third metaphor.
18-wheelers of logic. So this refers to the delivery system of each individual's information and the method of interpretation that is intended for such information. So picture the bridge of empathy as providing the terrain required to support the 18-wheeler truck, which is carrying the logic cargo from one individual to another. A manifest is included in this cargo, listing all of the included information and relevant rationales being employed and utilized. Each individual is encouraged to voluntarily choose which items are being unloaded off of the truck and which ones will be used and are being valued by that individual, or which ones are being left on the truck. So essentially, the bridge is what we use to transport information from one person to another. The 18-wheelers of logic is just a colorful way to describe what it is that we're trying to convey and to make it that, you know, to essentially give the idea that this can be organized and that it is very voluntary what is being shipped across, what is being accepted, what is being unloaded. And also, it's organized from both sides. So there's a manifest, a list of all the cargo that's inside. That's especially what I was trying to convey.
Yeah, it's interesting. As I read these last two together, I reflect on a lot of the conversations that I've been having with people here in Keene over the past few days, the bridge of empathy and the 18-wheeler of logic. And one thing that I said a couple of times is, please don't try to introduce your ideas to new people by running for some kind of office, which is something that a lot of people try to do. I have a lot of questions about the effectiveness of doing that. I see that more as like, instead of a bridge of empathy, like a minefield of disconnection. And what I'm getting at there is if you have ideas that you want to share with new people, let's just say in your community, like you're really committed to educating people, meet your neighbors, you know, make relationships. But what we see so much of is flame wars and, well, I'll be the, I'm trying to think of some local government elected position, but I can't think of any. I don't.
Councilman.
I'll be Councilman Vinat, and then you'll see that my ideas are good. So this is really powerful. And I hope that, you know, just explaining that in a little bit more detail, when people find themselves in these situations frustrated by this traffic jam of information that they want to communicate to somebody else, they ask themselves that question, well, have I done, you know, the necessary construction to be able to move this information? So I really like these two metaphors together. I think this is very powerful.
Help us out with the fourth metaphor that you just identified minutes ago.
Yeah, in the previous shows, we used the word lenses a lot. And when I first heard you referring to intellectual and empathetic lenses, it actually reminded me of a Google Health presentation that I saw, oh, I would say 3 or 4 months ago. And it was by a man named Daniel Siegel, Dr. Daniel Siegel, and it was called Taking Time In. And it was about self-awareness and presence. And he was talking about building a tripod for the camera that is the mind. And he talked about this tripod having different legs, openness to what is, objectivity, and observation. But what related to what we've said on our past two shows and what we said in the Trivium series is this is done in a non-judgmental way, right? You're not coming at people with diagnoses or prescriptions. It is a lens. It doesn't have any kind of filter. It doesn't have any kind of effects. It just takes in what is, whether we're talking about intellectually through the Trivium or empathetically through nonviolent or voluntary communication.
Precisely. And very important to always keep this in mind, to listen to the voices that are coming at us and try to help them see reality, such as the question of what does NVC say about this, or what does the Trivium say about that? I know I said that on the last show. I still think it's very relevant. These are tactical applications. These are methodologies. They don't say anything about anything. It's sort of like your glasses over on the table, the ones that you use for reading or for distance. They don't say anything either. They're just a tool. So what we're describing are tools. And what I do, what I like to tell people is what I do for my own upliftment, how I like to feel more uplifted in my life, is I like to collect lenses. I like to collect methodologies that help me to focus reality. What we're going over right now is some of my favorite and most useful methods of focusing reality that I have come across so far.
So can we talk about that? Let's start with the Trivium and the intellectual lenses. If we were going to talk about specific lenses in that realm, what would you say they are?
What I find very useful with understanding the metaphor of lenses is to keep in mind, just like the glasses on the table, we need to understand the condition of what we're using. So in the first aspect, seeing the intellectual side of myself and other individuals and the entire universe, I'm looking through the lens of the Trivium method of critical thinking. I'm asking questions consistently, the 5 W's plus how. I am attempting to have some form of intellectual equilibrium wherein I'm feeling some sense of enough things are balanced, meaning organized. I have basically not a lack of new ideas, nor do I have too many new ideas coming on in. I basically have some form of balance. And that's what I mean by intellectual equilibrium. I'm trying to design that. I desire it. I try to design it. I'm trying to engineer it and create it. I'm using these methods of the Trivium that you've now had a bunch of shows to describe. Mm-hmm. Then there's the other side, the empathetic side of myself and other individuals. I'm looking through the lens of nonviolent communication tactics. I'm understanding internally and externally observations, feelings, needs, requests, OFNR. Essentially, I'm understanding the four Ds. I have a translation matrix filter that can translate it, whether it's coming at me or if just in case anything comes out of me by mistake. I have an idea of what's going on. And I'm going for, again, equilibrium. I want to have my own feelings somewhat balanced. I realize I'm never going to be perfectly flatlined because that's dead. I'm going to have feelings reciprocal to how well I'm doing as far as my goals and as far as my actual situations related to my desires and values.
And just that second part was basically what we covered in our last installment of the show. Observations, feelings, needs, and requests, and really kind of contrasting that process and that understanding with those four Ds of disconnected communication: demands, diagnosis, deserve-oriented language, and denial of responsibility. So just that last little snip of yours, Daryl, we did about 50 minutes on that last time, so people can see how that fits.
Precisely.
I was also hoping that we could discuss some methods for the other metaphor that we're talking about, the bridge of empathy, and moving these heavy loads of logic eventually across that bridge. So where would we start with that? Because I think this is obviously something that happens within ourselves. I've always said that the most useful part of NVC is for self-talk, but ultimately we want to be able to translate it to other individuals. If we're going to talk about the methods for building this, where do we start?
I like to start with having all of this run smoothly like a computer program internally and externally. I like to have it running essentially OFNR to know how I observe things, to know what I'm feeling, to know what motivates those feelings, where do they come from, and essentially to understand my decision-making process, in other words, my logic, to know how it is that I utilize the trivium. And then to take appropriate action, to actually have a strategy of desiring a win-win scenario and to see some way to get through to having my motives, my values and desires tended to. And this is very important, just to have all of that running internally. The second part is to flip that around. Okay, say I already have that. I'm okay with it. And then I'm looking over there at Brett and I'm saying, how is he seeing the situation? What is his process of logic? What's it based on? Now, since I know you, I know that you're not going to be the most, I would say, rigorously bound to some religious protocol type of person, and you certainly have identified logical fallacies, but some people have. Say if I was talking with someone who has come from that pattern of very indoctrinated, very rigorous, held to a certain standard, and lots of traumatic patterning, the splinters essentially.
Mm-hmm.
So I have a very deep desire to understand the other person's observations, but also what it is that motivates them very much, like to figure that out through usually interpreting their feelings. I have a very strong desire to figure out what is their logical process? How do they make decisions? So I'm making an attempt to understand the other person's procedure for establishing what is logical and what is understandable. I need to have some level of understanding of that process, just even a little bit of it. There's a reason for this. After I figured this out, I need to make some attempt to respect the perspective of the other person to show that it's okay if they utilize something different than I do for their decision-making process. So I definitely wrote that one down in terms of someone using the idea, say, the Bible's true because it says in the Bible that it's true.
Mm-hmm.
Well, if someone was really coming to me like from that perspective, and that was not just them making a joke, but that was them being serious, I'd have to understand, okay, so they're coming to it from the perspective of the appeal to authority, the Bible is true, and the circular reasoning, because the Bible says that it's true. So okay. They're utilizing those two things, and that's their method of decision-making for that process. And they'll have other ones, too, for other decision-making needs. I need to show that it's okay for them to have their method of how they make decisions. And I can have my method for how I make my decisions. And, of course, you know, if I could demonstrate to them that I'm okay with them having their method, and here's how I make my method, and I'm not saying that they're wrong for their decision. I'm trying to say, hey, I can respect your decision. Would you be willing to respect the way I make my choices and my decisions? So I'm looking to start right there to understand them.
Now, that raises an interesting question, because I'm sure there are some people listening who might say, and I'd be interested to hear how you would respond, a person who talks like that needs to be held accountable, because that's a dangerous and irresponsible way of thinking.
Yeah, so that's a couple
that can cost people their lives.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Luckily, in most situations that I encounter in my life, I'm pretty sure that this would equate to many people. I mean, I've lived on the mainland. I've traveled some to other continents too. And everywhere I go, people could have certainly dangerous or faulty decision-making processes, but it doesn't negate the process of the bridge being needed before I can communicate to them. It doesn't change that, as far as I can tell. I still need a bridge to communicate to them effectively. So before I could communicate to them about their decision-making process, I still need to make a bridge. And that is why I'm choosing to first identify and, if necessary, demonstrate that I respect their choice for how they come to conclusions, as long as, just like good fences make good neighbors, essentially that we have some boundaries in place, meaning their decisions are for them. My decisions are for me, until we make some choice together saying, okay, they can choose for me in this case, or I can choose for them in that case. But usually, you know, we need some barrier. We need some actual boundary. And there is a way to convey that, to say, it's okay. You can own your decision-making process. I can own mine for now. So I do understand that there is danger, but for the most part, the danger is minimal if they're just, say, believing in some spaghetti monster, or, you know, essentially believing in some puppet show called politics. They can be rooting for a certain puppet on one side, and it's Punch, it's Judy, it's Punch, it's Judy. It's like they can do that, but how much does that really affect our lives right at the moment? Usually not that much.
If we're just constraining it to this conversation.
Yeah, yeah.
Like, to this interaction. Okay, yeah, sure.
For each specific interaction, there's not that much of an impact. For a cumulative effect of many people living in some delusion that seems apparently deluded, it's not going according to evidence, we can see that there's serious danger. If, you know, you give someone who has such decision-making power over life and death, you know, weaponry, authority, etc., that's a different scenario. And so then you really need to make a bridge of empathy. You know, you really need to isolate what the splinters are and not touch them if possible. So it just becomes more dire.
That's interesting, because the tendency, at least from my experience anyway, would be like, well, yeah, you can certainly be free to think whatever you want, but when 10 million people think like you do, it F's everything up for everybody. But there's nothing we can do in that one interaction where we're actually trying to have an effect. And hopefully, if we've checked ourselves and we know our own motivating factors for being there, we're only trying to communicate with this one other person. So it doesn't matter what 10 million other people might do. That's like irrelevant to this right. interaction. But it seems like, again, just from my own experience and from things I've heard and from things I've seen online, that's where it goes. It's people like you. You know, I'm pointing the finger at the other person in this fictitious interaction. It's people like you who are getting people killed and thrown in cages.
Yeah,
with your thinking.
Once again, that's the identification of a diagnosis that was unrequested. Mm. People like you. Not only was that unrequested, but that was actually completely not attached to any potential useful piece of information. It had no treatment plan attached to it. I can say this as a medical practitioner. If you don't have the patient or the client's consent for the diagnosis and you don't have an effective treatment plan, you're basically likely causing more problems. You're not really helping. So I understand that there's a desire. This is why people want to give a label. They want to give a diagnosis because they want understanding. So in the same way as we have the filter that can identify which 4D is going on, the diagnosis, people like you, that filter is there to help you understand. You can flip it around to the translation matrix. Diagnosis unrequested, that's someone who's seeking understanding and clarity. And it's very important to pay attention to your logical fallacies. It's a red herring what millions of people do when you're trying to make a bridge between you and another individual. It's very much paramount important to understand the objectives. What is the purpose, or what are the plural purposes of the conversation? And in what way does the interaction lead towards making life more wonderful for all concerned individuals? At every point, when you open your mouth, to have some tangible, applicable answer for those questions. That would be a wise choice, I think. I would advocate for that.
It reminds me of the Rosenberg phrase, tragic expression of unmet needs. When you talk about this diagnosis comes out because, well, somebody wants clarity.
Yeah.
You know, so the diagnosis is the fastest shortcut to at least the illusion of that.
It's been a pattern. It's not often looked at. It's just taken as a priori for granted. It's just people are doing it all over. And again, it's seeing the motivation behind that. There's the wisdom. There's the practical application of this information. So what I'm identifying in each case is saying, okay, each of the 4Ds, they are meaning something. The diagnosis, as we just identified, is essentially a looking for understanding, greater clarity. The essentially deserve-oriented language, that's also looking for some level of predictability. You know, if these people are punished and these people are rewarded, then everything is nice and predictable.
Mm-hmm.
And that's integrity, desire for having things and continuity, that type of consistency, that voluntarist principle, which we're get to hear so much about in all of the media that we consume. Consistency is very important, and it's very nearly universal. So all of these things are some of the motivating factors behind that deserve-oriented language. The denial of responsibility. Please be my mommy and daddy and take care of me. You know, someone be my mommy and daddy and take care of me. Like, I just finished watching Iron Man 3, where the guy disarms himself at the end of the movie. And I find that very actually relevant right there. They're giving a message out there saying, it's okay, you know, if you are armed, then you just draw violence to yourself. So just disarm yourself, and mommy and daddy government military will protect you and take care of you, and you can be okay. Essentially, that was the message that I got from the end of that movie. And
so would you say that security?
Safety and security was the desire. The strategy was to blow up all of his weaponry.
right. Okay. If we're going to run with the Iron Man 3, yeah. Yes, indeed.
Yeah. I'm going to run with that for just a second here, because I watch pop culture movies for a reason. I need to understand something. I have a great desire to understand something, which is what's going on around me. What are the messages that are being leveled all around me? And in the same way, to see the deserve-oriented language, denial of responsibility, making a demand, of course, is very simple. That's just someone making a request of this or that motive, this or that value or desire. They're just asking for it, essentially.
Mm-hmm.
Just in a rather disconnected type of way, because it's an either-or, demanding. It's understandable, you know, you can look through the OFNR lens very easily through yourself and to other people. You can look through the 4D lens through yourself and other people, and you could quickly figure out what's going on here. And that takes us into bridging methods. I wanted to now go right into how do I use OFNR to make an effective bridge of empathy. And I'll start off with that first one, which is speaking specifically in reference to the other person's motivating factors, their values, their desires, their needs. And this is basically the abstract concept. In other words, identifying what it is that the person is after. No proper nouns, just the thing, essentially, like safety and security with Iron Man 3. And going right to it, just making mention of it. I find this is very effective in disarming, you know, mounting tension and conflict. I go right for it often. It's usually my first go-to.
Then the second one is speaking about our own feelings. And I think what is so often substituted here is a diagnosis for the other person, right? Which might stem from a feeling that we have, but when we speak of our own feelings, it shows a little bit of vulnerability. You'd have to gauge the situation. We wouldn't want to do it if it was going to be confused with an attempt to get pity from the person that we're interacting with.
Yeah, it's possible that this could cause a bridge by showing essentially, hey, this is what's real and alive in me.
Mm.
Now, of course, you have to keep this in mind. It is also possible that someone can interpret that as rather like superfluous information that they did not want to know about, and now they heard it and they don't even know what to do with it, and it's just uncomfortable. So all of these tactics are not a guarantee of causing or creating and building a bridge of empathy. They're just possible directions that you could go down that might actually help.
What's coming to my mind is what we referred to in the last show as the worst sentence in the world, right? And that was the NVC Mad Libs line that many of us first heard when, you know, we were introduced to NVC. Have you ever looked at and we did a show about this once on School Sucks Podcast, what has been called street NVC, or there was another presentation I saw called naturalizing or normalizing NVC, as far as like how this information, you know, speaking in reference to another person's needs and speaking about what we're feeling ourselves is done in a way that doesn't short circuit somebody else, especially if they're already in a heightened state of emotion.
I'm familiar with some of the videos that go over those concepts.
Mm-hmm.
And from what I remember, they're very, very focused on the feelings needs aspect.
Okay.
Or the emotions and motivating factors. They're not very focused on observations for both individuals or the actual actions, often manifesting in NVC language as requests. And they're often not very focused on actual boundaries, a very important concept that I find that really helps for individuals to feel very safe and respected.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm finding that it's useful, of course, because especially with people who love each other, there is great value in this tactic. There's some interest already for people who love each other to actually take time to share what they're feeling, to share what motivates those feelings, to share their values and desires and needs. But there's less of that with the people who don't care that much about each other or who've never met each other until just then.
Mm.
So this is very relevant. It's the context, the contextual circle around the rhetorical triangle again. Keeping these things in mind. Who is the author? What is the message? Hopefully it's designed to go to the audience. And the audience hopefully is being understood. So my third bridging method that I'm using the motivating factors aspect is to speak of my own motivating factors, my own needs, my own values and desires. Unless I think this could be confused as an attempt to beg or persuade, or some type of confusion could happen by essentially showing something that was contradictory to what the other person was valuing and desiring at that moment. It does at least go into the realm of the abstract. So if I'm speaking of a value and desire, there are not strategies that you can identify. If I speak of safety and security, it does not include pushing the button and having my Iron Man suits explode in fireworks display. That
right.
is not, that is a strategy. The safety and security is the value. or the motive or the actual desire or need.
And the fourth element here is to speak of the other person's feelings. And this is where things could get a little touchy, because what can happen is that, you know, if you're talking about somebody else's feelings, this could be confused with a diagnosis or some other, you know, psychological intrusion into a place where they're really not, you know, something in them that they're really not comfortable having you explore right then and there. So that's that one seems like kind of a challenge to me. I mean, obviously, all of this is a challenge until it's practiced, Daryl. But that one of these four that we just went through, that seems to be the toughest.
It's the most volatile. Mm-hmm. It's the one that I choose to employ the least often. And it is the one that I see people who are studying NVC for whatever reason seem to go right for. They go right for describing what the other person is feeling to them. And this is very volatile. It sometimes even the use of the word need is volatile. And that's why I've switched to use other words, because of the wobble with the definition of that word. But, you know, when it comes down to it, there are many people out there, they would prefer to keep their emotions private. I just listened to the other show and it sounded like I described this more eloquently then, but essentially, this is a private territory that you really, I would say it would be very useful to have serious explicit permission to go into, that someone is willing to have their feelings being explored by you before you mention it. And so those are using the feelings and needs or feelings and motivating factors as methods of bridge building. And you can see why I started with talking about the other person's relevant motives. That's mm-hmm. relevant. And it's abstract. So it's usually the subtext. It's not what's usually going on. That's very powerful. It's relevant to them. So it's not a change of topic. And that is infuriating to people who are already ready to explode. You don't want to do that. So it's relevant. And it's also connected to the subject at hand. Disarming. It's useful.
The fourth one is probably easier. If you've been thorough and made an effort with the first three, that invitation probably appears more often. Obviously, like you mentioned, with most people who are practicing NVC in a very novice way, when they say, oh, well, I see you're feeling blank in the leadoff position, that's not going to go anywhere. But I think you do stand a better chance of having somebody be more vulnerable and more willing to open up if you've been somewhat rigorous with, or let's just say rigorous with the other three.
Now, I wanted to mention that it's not necessarily true that I'm going to start off going right into speaking to the other person's motives. That mm-hmm. might not be so, because the person might be very grounded in the 3D world. And these abstract concepts, these intangibles, are not really the best way to bridge to someone who really prefers to speak and think about the tangible world. So in that instance, I will go to using observations and requests or actions. Specifically, I might go to the first one, which is to speak to how the other person observes the situation from their perspective, as best as I can ascertain. Definitely a possible way of connecting, to say, to demonstrate that you really are paying attention to what the other person is after, what they're, how they see the world, how they see this present situation.
So next, as the communicator, I could try to speak to how I observed the situation. And I would want to be cautious not to, you know, set this up in a way where it could be confused with an attempt to persuade or imply some inaccuracy on the part of the other person.
I can say this. Look, I observed you drove into the driveway at that speed and it kicked up that much gravel. And that was my observation right there. There's no implication except for what the other person could think that you're thinking in your head about that, about the gravel that sprayed up, because they drove that speed on, you know, that terrain basically, and there I was seeing it. So you're giving them your perspective now. Mm-hmm. That could be an opening right there, because they might actually be interested in your perspective. They might have not thought about that before. Oh, that's why he always looks at me when I drive out that at that speed, because mm-hmm. of that. And there's an understanding, like, there, I'm a human being standing on the driveway. Gravel flies at this speed when you drive with your wheels at that speed. And I'm just sharing the observation. You can make of it what you will. You can imagine all types of things in your mind. I'm sure you will. You're not going to stop. This is a potential bridge, but again, it has to not. You have to be very careful to avoid any type of confusion that there's some implication going on. You crazy driver. You know,
yeah, you're
that
not
type of
slipping
thing.
Anything in.
Right, right, yeah. So observations don't have evaluations in them. An observation is what the video camera takes in.
Right.
And that's the important aspect that I wanted to underline there. I might want to choose to speak about the actual requests or actions that I'm taking in terms of what I'm actually looking for, if I'm making a request of them, or if I'm actually making some type of action. I could speak about that choice of action. I could speak making an actual request. But I'm trying to be careful to make sure that they're not interpreting that request as a demand. That's something that's very tricky. So again, that whole worst sentence in the world thing, this is the important part. That's the end part of that whole thing. That request at the end of that sentence can so easily be interpreted as a demand. So that would be the, you know, seventh method of building a bridge. It could actually work. I could actually make a request.
And lastly, you could try to speak to how the other person chooses to respond. So in other words, their requests or actions. But you would want to be careful that this doesn't appear to them as a diagnosis.
Precisely. It's very important. You see, I have them listed this way because they're kind of in descending order of, you know, starting from least likely to be interpreted as fightin' words, least likely to be interpreted as some type of conflict that's being engineered, and then going to the easiest to be interpreted as conflict enhancement. So essentially what I'm looking to do is I'm looking to communicate. I'm looking to show that I am aware of what mm-hmm. they are after. I'm aware of what the purpose is of the conversation, not just from my perspective, but from their perspective. And I have this in mind. If I don't have it in mind, then I'm quickly trying to identify it, because without that, there's not really much point in the communication to me. I need to have the goals set and the purpose set. And I live in the land, by the way, where people do something called talk story. Hawaiian pidgin is a very funny language. Talk story just means people just coming around to talk and share these long and lengthy, sometimes pointless stories about things going on. And that is very helpful and useful. People are sharing what's alive in them. You can see it in their eyes and you can see it in their body expression. So what I'm often trying to do, though, is I'm trying to see, well, how do I really continue the talk story experience, but actually have a good solid bridge between me and them, such different people we are. I don't really run into people where I could say, oh, that person there, just like me. It's like, no, it doesn't happen really. But once in a while, at least, I can find someone who has something, some interests that are similar. So all of these methods are just using observations, feelings, needs, requests, or I would say more specifically, observations, feelings, motivating factors, and actions as ways to form the bridge, essentially. I'm looking to say, to communicate what's relevant to them. I'm an active listener. I'm paying attention to what mm-hmm. is going on with them. And I'm demonstrating this attention by virtue of reiteration, repeating back to them something, showing them that I'm paying attention to very relevant factors.
Just a simple shorthand for driving that home, an observation is not an interpretation or a label. A feeling is not a thought. A need is not a strategy. And a request is not a demand.
Yeah, see, it's very important to isolate these things. And this plus the actual explainable, explicit creation of boundaries goes a long way towards helping to create respect and understanding, which is the subjective goal. A bridge of empathy is just saying, okay, now we respect each other, and now we can actually take the time to communicate. And here, I'm going to throw one out more for you, Brett. When I was having trouble communicating with a friend one time, I tried to figure out and put my finger on what was going on when I was doing a not so lengthy description of something that I found very compelling and interesting. Mm-hmm. And what I was told was that it sounded like I was trying to persuade them. And I thought about it and I said, huh, well, here's something that we can always do. Anytime that you hear me speaking of something and you're noticing this uncomfortable feeling, you can simply ask me the question, are you trying to persuade me of something? Because if the answer is yes, I'm going to be clamming up pretty quick and trying to backpedal and say, no, I don't mean to try to persuade you. I find this really fascinating and compelling. I research all manner of subjects. I have a lot of words that I wish to come out of my mouth to various people. So thank you for letting me know about that. I'm going to try to keep this in check and pay attention, again, to my audience and their interest level.
Hmm. Yeah, that's one of the challenges with so many of the things that we want to talk about, that it's hard to understand what it means to another person. And, you know, we see it as something that's exciting. And I mean, I've explored a number of my motivations for doing this, and I think some are healthy and some honestly were not. But what that feels like to the other person when somebody comes up, and I won't say how your presentation was, but you know, from my presentation in the past was like, oh, I have some new information for you, you know, that kind of a thing. And that's unrequested. And a lot of that new information, even though I saw it as being very important, might be unsettling, or certainly something that people were not asking for or were not willing to welcome in that place at that time. So, yeah, I think that obviously being more aware of our own motivations helps us be more empathetic and understanding of what other people might go through when we act on them.
Right. And so there's a lot of words like seems like, and I got the impression that. Mm-hmm. We're going to be fielding these words. They're going to be coming towards us. I know this. I'm pretty sure, Brett, these words are coming towards us at various times because of the limitations of the words that we're using and the limitations of the skill level of the people that we communicate with. So what's going on is there are splinters. And when we are saying things that might be touching upon the splinters, the cognitive dissonance, the uncomfortable feeling of something that contradicts a conclusion that they felt very safe and comfortable with, such as the conclusion that it was the violent Iron Man weaponry which drew the bad guys to try to blow up the dude's house. When, of course, that's not necessarily true, that, you know, A equals B, or that correlation is causation. But essentially, you know, it was a comfortable thought for many people, I'm sure, who watched this to say, oh, isn't that nice? He disarmed himself to say, I love you, babe, so much that I'm going to blow up all my guns. You know, it's like that's a great thing to dissect right there, because you're seeing, understanding like that if a person was comfortable with that message, that's very difficult for them to hear it spelled out so plainly. So that's actually going to touch upon things that are really uncomfortable, in the same way as if I pointed out their emotions. Hey, I bet you feel really uncomfortable now, huh? How are you going to handle that? And that is pushing on the splinter, pushing it further, you know. And I don't recommend that strategy. I have tried it in the past. I have found it to yield less desirable results. So what I'm looking at for instead,
I'm just picturing like the splinter, like I'm trying to help, I'm just gonna push this out of the other side of your body. I want to get it out of you. I'm just gonna push it right through. It's to help, I promise. I'm helping.
Yeah, it's a great big broken off baseball bat coming right through the chest, and you know,
yeah,
I'd say surgery, please. But you know, But voluntary, you know, and it's very important. Just the perspective that I'm trying to enhance right here, to be aware of the splinters of oneself is one thing. That's brilliant. If you could do all of this internally, that would be the end point goal. I mean, that would be ultimate. But then to go the steps further, to be aware of what is alive in the other person, including their splinters. So I got to find out that as I'm sharing certain things, my enthusiasm, they can put that aside. They can hear me on my motives. It was not meant to persuade. Okay, they can believe me. They give me the benefit of the doubt. Assume benevolence is a very useful tool. Just to take the assumption that the person really doesn't mean you ill by expressing their opinions and thoughts. So then to go the step further and say, okay, cognitive dissonance is happening. Splinters are being touched upon. And to hear the reasons why, that they don't have the ability right then and there to look up any pieces of data that might, say, poke holes in the theories that I'm proposing. And that's understandable, that they feel frustrated because I'm saying something contradictory to them, and now that is touching upon their splinter. So I'm instantly trying to say, hey, hold on. You don't have to take this as an accepted conclusion, because I don't do that belief thing anymore as much as I can. I try to say, hey, if I was a betting man, I would bet on this, but you, I'm not saying you should bet on this. If you have data that supports a different conclusion, you should bet on that. I'm glad that I bet on Bitcoin right now. I can tell you that.
Yeah.
But, you know, people in the past, they could say, I'm not going to bet on that. That's based on nothing. And I'm saying, okay, yeah, you can go ahead and bet on that. Well, you know, guess what? It's November 25th, Monday, and I think that we can see what happens, you know, in the betting world in that specific instance. But there are many other conclusions that are very, very academic. You know, aliens, ancient artifacts, all these types of things. It means that what I mean by academic is that there's no direct implication on our present decisions, usually, unless you're about to take a ride in a disc craft of some sort or go through a jump gate to Mars. But unless that's happening, you can just completely speculate until you see some evidence of friction, emotionally speaking. And that is the sign of the splinters being touched. And there we have the chance to demonstrate that we respect them as an individual, that we respect their choice to have strong beliefs or conclusions that might be contradictory, that they wish to uphold. We can demonstrate that we understand that and that they are free to go in that direction. That if they're interested, but they don't have to hear it out, they can hear us on how we're going and what we plan to do, you know, our decision-making process, our conclusions that we hold so far. Mm-hmm. We have the choice of that, but it's best to make that as a request rather than, yeah, just listen to me ramble on about this. You know, again, the same thing with the rhetorical triangle. Please pay attention to your audience and their interest level is what I would advocate.
So we spent a considerable amount of time tonight talking about the establishing of an empathetic connection and building that bridge. I think in our concluding conversation next week, people would like to hear about some additional strategies, statements, and phrases to help generate this connection and some discussion about how these 18-wheelers ultimately cross these bridges. So you'll come back one more time and we'll do a conclusion?
Certainly will. I'm pretty psyched about it.
New subscriber, geography, trivia. You just say a person's name and tell a fact about where they live.
That angry grandpa will teach you otherwise, I'll tell you that. Oh boy, here we go with some trivia. Let's start with Marshall P. in San Diego, California. Well, you know, first of all, here's a strange fact. Hypnotism was banned by public schools in San Diego. Isn't that kind of ironic? Also, San Diego is home to the largest wooden structure in the entire country, the Hotel del Coronado on Coronado Island. And the city boasts more fleas than any other in the country. Next, we move on to David K. in Barrington, Rhode Island. Well, Money Magazine ranked Barrington sixth on its list of the best 100 places to live in the United States. Spalding Gray, the actor, screenwriter, and playwright, grew up there. And Nicholas Bianco, the boss of the Patriarca crime family, once called Barrington Home. So he agreed with the, you know, Money magazine. Next, we have Daniel K. in Tequesta, Florida. Listen to the natives and residents that this city boasts. Burt Reynolds, folks. Burt Reynolds, Joe Namath, the great Jets quarterback, and Keith Hernandez of Seinfeld fame, who I also understand had a pretty decent baseball career with the New York Mets. But he's now in Tequesta with Burt Reynolds. I mean, Burt Reynolds and Keith Hernandez, that almost sounds like a little too much mustache for one town for me, folks, you know? Next, we move on to Marlon G. in Taylor, Michigan. This is the birthplace of Hungry Howie's Pizza, the 11th largest pizza chain in the United States. And they've got almost 600 locations. Founded in 1973, their claim to fame is flavored crust. You know, if you go to Hungry Howie's, you can get like a barbecue flavored crust or ranch flavored crust. I know, gross, right? Next, we have Travis G. in Bradenton, Florida. I think Bradenton is the birthplace of Free Talk Live, but I'm not sure, so I'm just kind of saying that. Here are some things that I noticed about Bradenton that I thought were interesting. They seem to lionize the conquistadors down there. There's a Hernando de Soto Historical Society, a de Soto Square, a de Soto National Memorial, and there's also the Cortez Fishing Village named after Hernando Cortez, who was not a good guy, but the village, as it stands today, fine place to go out and get some shrimp or some snapper, you know, stone crabs. All right. Next, we have Ben D. in Philadelphia, Pennsylvania, city of firsts. Listen to these. Let's do some patriotic trivia. First of all, Philadelphia, site of the first presidential mansion. Betsy Ross made the first American flag in Philadelphia. In 1946, Philadelphia became home to the first computer. Benjamin Franklin founded the first zoo in the United States, Philadelphia Zoo in Philadelphia. And in 1775, the first piano built in America by Johann Berendt, done in Philadelphia. How about that? Next, we have Jacob C. in Tulsa, Oklahoma. Let's do some roadway trivia for Tulsa. The yield sign. You've seen yield signs out there, you know, when you're tooting about. First used on a trial basis in Tulsa, Oklahoma. Also, in 1925, there was a Tulsa businessman named Cyrus Avery, who became known after some of his achievements as the father of Route 66. So you've all heard of Route 66. There's a song, and that's kind of Tulsa's claim to fame, it turns out. So this businessman wanted to connect Chicago to California, and he established an association to do that in Tulsa, and the city earned the nickname the birthplace of Route 66. And that was actually very important to the city's development. So Route 66 and the yield sign, straight out of Tulsa. Next, we have Trevor M. in Winnipeg, Manitoba. We talked about Winnipeg before, the birthplace of Winnie the Pooh. It was also the first city to develop 911, the emergency phone number. And Neil Young grew up in Winnipeg, it turns out, and he was kicked out of high school because he would walk around playing his guitar in the halls. And schools don't encourage that kind of thing. Next, we have John T., who's in Omaha, Nebraska. Hey, if you're ever there, you're going to want to check out the Henry Dorley Zoo and Aquarium. The Laid Jungle, located there, is the world's largest indoor rainforest, and the Desert Dome is the world's largest indoor desert. They also have the world's largest glazed geodesic dome. So, you know, Henry Dorley Zoo and Aquarium. And then you have the whole Warren Buffett thing. Let's skip that, okay? Next, we have Hunter S., who's in Fort Lauderdale, Florida. This, now, Fort Lauderdale's a special place for me because two of my favorite childhood movies took place in Fort Lauderdale. The first one was Disney's 1986 classic, Flight of the Navigator, where a boy is taken in a spaceship, you know, and he goes and he has wonderful adventures with a talking ship. See Flight of the Navigator. If you haven't seen it, you could probably find it on YouTube in its entirety at this point. Also, taking place in Fort Lauderdale, another classic, 1987, Revenge of the Nerds Part 2, Nerds in Paradise. Remember that one when the fellas won over that crowd of jocks and frat boys and popular kids with the rap? Oh, man, movie magic. And finally, we have Woodrow B. in Somerville, South Carolina, the hometown of YouTube sensation Angry Grandpa. And I said, who's Angry Grandpa? And then I put it into YouTube. I was not disappointed. In fact, if you've been listening to the show for a while, you probably heard me express my concerns and frustrations about how people out there who are supposed to provide products and services are kind of expecting the consumer to be a meek pushover. Angry Grandpa will teach you otherwise, I'll tell you that. I admire his firmness. I admire his inquisitiveness. I do think he could benefit from listening to a couple episodes in the series that Daryl and I have been working on, though. I think he'll see what I mean. Let's play a clip. Here he is dealing with the DirecTV customer service people.
What do you mean by bank card number to give me a goddamn price on the installation and the total price? I don't need my name. You got my goddamn address, but you don't need my bank card. Now, all I want from you is a goddamn price on what's it gonna cost. You don't need my bank card to find that out. Now, can I ask you a question? Is the price going to change if you have my account number? In other words, it's going to be the same price before I give you my card number, and when I give it to you, it's still going to be the same price. So what the fuck do you need my card number for? Why you got to transfer me to anybody? Why can't you just give me a goddamn price?
Later on in that video, he expresses a tremendous frustration with the Indian accent of the person on the phone and refers to them as a Taiwan Charlie. And in addition to Angry Grandpa, Somerville, South Carolina, also known for its beautiful flower gardens.
New subscriber geography trivia.